If you happen to win the lottery, your financial situation would work out great, wouldn't it? Actually, according to a recent study, the answer is maybe not. Three economics professors wrote a paper in 2010 titled "The Ticket to Easy Street: The Financial Consequences of Winning the Lottery." Their research tried to address the question, does a lottery windfall have a permanent impact, or does it merely postpone financial pain? Does sudden prosperity solve people's financial problems or just delay them? The professors obtained a list of winners for a Florida lotto game called Fantasy Five, and they compared those names on that list to Florida bankruptcy records, and to see how winners winning the jackpot, how that affected and how it related to the bankruptcy records. They found that people who won small amounts were more likely to file bankruptcy than people who won larger amounts in the short term, but someone who won very large lottery tickets, lottery winners, were more likely to file for bankruptcy than small winners 3 years down the road. Winning big doesn't solve problems. In many cases, it makes them worse. And that is especially true for Christians in terms of prosperity in our lives. Our prosperity tests our spirituality. Joseph in Genesis 41 goes from prison to power, from poverty to wealth, from last to first, literally overnight. And it's as if he won the Egyptian lottery and much, much more, just like that. He has lived faithfully for the Lord through 11 years of slavery, 2 years of prison. He has followed God, and now God is going to call him to live faithfully with wealth and power. I think it is easier to be faithful when you have little. The real test of faithfulness is when you have much. And we in America are quite prosperous compared to the rest of the world. How do we handle our prosperity, though? It's a real test. There are three lessons on prosperity that I want us to learn from Joseph this morning. First of all, our prosperity depends on God, not on us. Verse 37. Now the proposal seemed good to Pharaoh and to all his servants. Then Pharaoh said to his servants, "Can we find a man like this in whom is a divine spirit?" So Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Since God has informed you of all this, there is no one so discerning and wise as you are. You shall be over my house, and according to your command, all my people shall do homage. Only in the throne I will be greater than you." Pharaoh said to Joseph, "See, I have set you over all the land of Egypt." Then Pharaoh took off his signet ring from his hand. He put it on Joseph's hand, clothed him in garments of fine linen, put the gold necklace around his neck. He had him ride in his second chariot, and they proclaimed before him, "Bow the knee." And he set him over all the land of Egypt. Moreover, Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Though I am Pharaoh, yet without your permission, no one shall raise his hand or foot in all the land of Egypt." Then Pharaoh named Joseph Zaphnath-Paneah, and he gave him Asenath, the daughter of Potiphar, a priest of On, as his wife. And Joseph went forth over the land of Egypt. Two Bible characters, excluding Jesus, of course, that have nothing bad said about them in the Bible. Two Bible characters. Do you know them? They are Daniel and Joseph. Nothing bad is said about either Daniel or Joseph in the biblical record. What is remarkable, truly remarkable, about both of those men is that they both served in positions of power and wealth, high government positions, and yet were faithful to God. Wealthy, powerful people but lived lives that were faithful to God. Few believers ever would hold the power and wealth of Joseph. Pharaoh made him number two in the kingdom. Egypt was one of the most powerful, richest nations in the world at the time. The greatest pyramids had been completed hundreds of years before Joseph lived. Overnight, Joseph became ruler of an empire with a glorious history, a powerful military, a rich economy. Joseph held the signet ring of power. He was clothed in the richest wardrobe money could buy. He socialized with the celebrities on their Nile River yachts. Servants waited on his every whim. He rode in a chariot, sort of ancient Air Force Two. The crowds bowed before him when he went down the streets. His wife was the daughter of the priest of On, later called Heliopolis. The city was located close to Giza, the site of the greatest pyramids and temple complexes in Egyptian history. Chephron's temple complex was well established long before the time of Joseph. How did Joseph respond to all of that wealth, all of that power? Well, he didn't refuse it. He didn't say no. Sometimes we can fall into the trap that many Christians fall into, sort of developing a reverse spiritual snobbery. Wealth and power are antithetical to spirituality, according to many. That's not true, as both Daniel and Joseph prove. Many people imply that spiritual people cannot be prosperous. That's not true at all. It is true that it is far harder to be faithful spiritually. But Joseph is a prime example of how to handle prosperity for the Lord. Joseph didn't turn down the promotion. He didn't say, oh, no, I can't do that. I don't want that. Joseph didn't turn down the promotion. He embraced it. He is achieving the dream that God gave him 13 years earlier, over 13 years earlier, as a young teenager. Remember those dreams? God called him. What happens when you achieve your dreams? Most of us don't worry about that because we never achieve those kinds of dreams in terms of the material world in which we live. But what happens if you do? Prosperity can ruin you. Promotions can destroy your walk with God. Many people have lost their way with God in the prosperity of this world. Look, America as a nation is a good example of that. We have grown prosperous, and quite frankly, prosperity is ruining our nation. America was never a Christian nation. That's simply not true. But we did stand for Judeo-Christian principles in our founding and in our moral and spiritual lives. The morality of our nation is disintegrating, has been for decades now. James Montgomery Boyce wrote in 1987 these words, "God is our only source of morality, not the government, not the courts, not the laws. Goodness flows from God. So if we leave God out of our lives, we begin to lose touch with what is good and tear away the fabric of morality strand by strand." And he said that's what's happening in our country in 1987. Donald Gray Barnhouse wrote, "The secret of power is character, but the secret of character is God." If God blesses you with prosperity, remember the source is God, and He intends you to use it for Him. God has blessed America with prosperity. He intended us to use it for Him. Elizabeth said earlier, God blesses us to bless others, not for our own benefit, but so He can use it, for it is His. So keep your eyes on God. Stay in tune with His Word. It is so easy to begin to credit ourselves, when we have success. And it is so easy to lose sight of God in that success. So trust God, not your wealth, not your prosperity, not your possessions, not your power, not your positions. Joseph lived that philosophy. He knew his prosperity depended on God, not him. And Pharaoh even knew it. Did you catch that in this story? Pharaoh testified to that reality. He said in verse 39, since God has informed you of all of this. You remember when he tried to get Joseph to interpret his dreams, Joseph said, it's not me, it's God. Now Pharaoh says, God did it. I know that, so you shall be over all my house. Even the Pharaoh knew that God was the source of Joseph's success. And Pharaoh gave Joseph an Egyptian name, a great big long one, which means God's word speaking life. How would you like to be named that? What's your name? God's word speaking life. That's what he named Joseph. Everywhere he went, as the second in the charge of the entire kingdom, he was introduced as God's word speaking life. Pharaoh gave credit to God, not to Joseph. And he wanted Joseph in charge of his kingdom because of God and the fact that he could see that God was doing something in this man. So he wanted him in charge of the kingdom of Egypt. Isn't that a great testimony? When the boss promotes you, does he promote you because he knows God is blessing you? Guiding you? If he does, that honors God for your testimony. The boss knows you will handle the company resources well because you are conscientious, because God is leading you. You are following God in everything you do. Does your boss see God at work in your life? Do your employees give credit to God for how you handle your responsibilities, how you manage and take care of those who work for you? That's your responsibility. If we are living out God's values in this world, then others are going to notice that and testify to God's work in our lives and God's call on our lives. Do we use our wealth and power to benefit others? Are we using our positions to get ahead for ourselves or to give back to this world? Living for God starts with understanding that we depend on God for our success. And His goals are our goals, even in the business world. Chuck Colson told the following story about his hometown of Naples, Florida, which he calls one of the garden spots of the world. It's an absolute nirvana for all the golfers, he said. They all come there. They're all CEOs of major corporations, and they retire to Naples. This is it. 27 golf courses and miles of sparkling beach. And the best country clubs. And he said, I watch those guys. They're powerful people. They have that New York businessman aura about them, that determination, that power. But now all of a sudden they're measuring their lives by how many golf games they get in during the day. And he says, I often say to them, or said to them, do you really want to live your life counting up the number of times you chase that little white ball around these greens? And they kind of chuckle, but he said it's really a nervous chuckle, because in 6 months they've realized how worthless their lives really are, how boring, and they're bored with it. They've got beautiful homes, castles really. And when they get bored with that castle, they build a bigger castle. And they're miserable, he said. And here's his words. The object of life is not what we think it is, which is to achieve money, power, and pleasure. That's not the Holy Grail. The object of life is the maturing of the soul. And you reflect that maturing of the soul when you care more for other people than yourself. Our prosperity depends on God. Secondly, our prosperity tests our faithfulness. get there. There we go. Our prosperity tests our faithfulness. Verse 46. Now Joseph was 30 years old when he stood before Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And Joseph went out from the presence of Pharaoh, went through all the land of Egypt. During the 7 years of plenty, the land brought forth abundantly. So he gathered all the food of these 7 years which occurred in the land of Egypt, placed the food in the cities. He placed in every city the food from its own surrounding fields. Thus Joseph stored up grain in great abundance like the sand of the sea until he stopped measuring it, for it was beyond measure. Now before the year of famine came, two sons were born to Joseph, whom Asenath, the daughter of Potiphar, a priest of On, bore to him. Joseph named the firstborn Manasseh, for he said, God has made me forget all my trouble in all my father's household. He named the second Ephraim, for he said, God has made me fruitful in the land of my affliction. And Joseph was a busy guy. He had 7 years of prosperity, and he had responsibility to prepare the Egyptian Empire for the 7 years of famine that were coming. So he had 7 years to implement a business plan that would take care of the people during the 7 years of drought. And God had gifted this man with tremendous administrative skills. And he went to work organizing the Department of Agriculture. He put into action the plan. Now, he had proposed it. Remember, we studied back in verse 34 of this chapter. He had proposed the plan himself. He appointed overseers in charge of the cities. Each overseer taxed the people at 20% during these 7 years of prosperity. The grain was gathered into storehouses in each city. Now, that's a pretty hefty tax, 20%. So Joseph must have explained to the people what this was all about. They were saving for the time of famine. They were saving for the hard times that were coming. They collected this 20% tax. And during the 7 years of bumper crops, the 20% tax at least was doable because they were doing well. They were getting a lot in their crops already. They had plenty. They stored up the grain until he stopped trying to measure it anymore. Joseph travels extensively all over the country, making sure that everything was done properly, justly, and efficiently. He's a good leader. I'll say this again. I think it is easier to be faithful when you have little. When you have much, the heart is tested in a much greater way. I have known very few who are given the test of managing much, but a few I've known. When you're making multi-million dollar deals in the corporate world and hundreds of jobs depend upon your every decision, that is stress. And it is huge. And it is hard. Wealth, position, and power will test the heart of any Christian in ways most of us cannot even begin to imagine because we just don't live in that world. Joseph faced huge pressures in his day. His heart had to be tested severely by the pressures of this world. It is so easy to lose sight of God in the midst of all of that, all of that prosperity, all of those decisions. It is so easy to lose sight of God because money and power are God's heart tests. When you are in charge of much, God, you answer to God. And you face the pressure of all those who depend upon your decisions. And that is God's call on your life. And it's not easy. Sometimes, though, I think like Tevye and Fiddler on the Roof, you know, when he says that, hey, maybe God could test me a little bit with much instead of what I've got to deal with all the time with poverty. I mean, you know, I'd like to try the other test for a little while. You ever feel like that? Yeah, bring it on, God. I'll try it a little bit. I'd like to try that test. When I was in Morocco, one of the Christian businessmen jokingly said to me, he said, God had blessed America with much, and he'd just like to try that test for a little while. And then he laughed, because of course he knew it wasn't true for all Americans. Why doesn't God test me with much? Have you ever asked yourself that? I think it's because I'd probably fail the test. I don't have the gifts to manage much. And God knows that. So he gives me what I can manage for him and calls me accountable for what he gives me. It's so easy to be corrupted by the wealth of this world and to lose sight of God in our pursuit of this world. According to Amnesty International, North Korea has this vast network of prisons. They imprison over 200,000 people in North Korea. The most feared camp is known as Total Control Camp 14. Nice name. Hunger is so rampant that prisoners behave like panicked animals at mealtime. Teachers at the camp school beat students to death for minor infractions. Medieval torture devices are employed in dungeon-like underground cells at Total Control Camp 14. The book Escape from Camp 14 tells the gripping story of Shin Dong-hyuk, the first known escapee from Camp 14 in North Korea. He was actually born in Camp 14. At the age of 23, he escaped, finding his way to South Korea, eventually the United States. Can you imagine the contrast? Today, Shin lives in Seoul, South Korea, a nation that in many ways resembles the United States and other developed countries. 2012, there was a documentary done on him. Towards the end of an interview in that documentary, Shin said, "When I lived in the labor camp, I had to suffer a lot of pain. But in South Korea, you have to suffer when you don't have enough money. It's exhausting. It's all about money. That makes it tough for me here. When I think about it, I rarely saw someone committing suicide in the camp. Life was hard, and you were an inmate your whole life. But in South Korea, many people attempt suicide. They die. It may look like the people here don't want for anything. They have clothes and food, but there are more people committing suicide here than in the camp. There are news reports about that every day." The interviewer asked him in the documentary, "What do you miss about the life in North Korea?" You'd think, nothing, right? Shin got out his cell phone, started looking at it for a minute, tapping at the screen, and then he said, "I miss the innocence and the lack of concerns I had in the camp. I didn't have to think about the power of money like I do in South Korea. Though I don't miss everything from that camp, I don't know how else to say it, I miss my innocent heart." That's powerful. I miss my innocent heart. I wonder if there were days like that for Joseph, thinking back to his days in prison. Now life was filled with hard responsibilities and tough choices and criticism and struggle about what to do and how to handle things and arguments over money. And maybe he missed his innocent heart back there in prison at times. I mean, Joseph lived in luxury. He traveled extensively. He hobnobbed with the rich and powerful of his day. He didn't try to get rid of it all. He didn't try to give it away. He knew that God had put him in that position for a reason. He's preparing a nation for the time of famine. He knew that God wanted him to use his power and his wealth to prepare a nation for those coming hard times. And he had to be faithful to that calling, just as you have to be faithful to your calling and to what he asks you to manage for him, because it's all his. We see glimpses that Joseph kept his eyes on God in these verses. So far as we know, Joseph remained faithful to one wife in a polygamous world. I see his faithfulness to do his job even in a politically difficult world. He could easily have used his power to benefit himself instead of for the people of Egypt. There must have been criticisms leveled at him for what he was doing. But most important, I see his faithfulness in how he named his two sons. Now, we've studied in Genesis how important names were in the ancient world. They didn't just casually name people because it sounded good. They named them for religious reasons, for purpose, for social reasons. And so he named his two sons to express his faith in God. Manasseh, as a reminder of the fact that God had made him forget all of his troubles from the past. He gave the credit to God. Joseph named his second son Ephraim because God had made him fruitful in his land of suffering. Joseph constantly gave credit to God for all his success. His eyes were still on God. He didn't lose sight of God and his prosperity. His heart was tested. He passed the test. He remained faithful to God with much. Our prosperity, third, requires good stewardship. Verse 53. When the 7 years of plenty, which had been in the land of Egypt, came to an end, and the 7 years of famine began to come, just as Joseph had said, you see, he'd been warning the people, save, 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 the hard times are coming for this nation. Then there was famine in all the lands, but in all the land of Egypt there was bread. So when all the land of Egypt was famished, the people cried out to Pharaoh for bread. And Pharaoh said to all the Egyptians, go to Joseph. Whatever he says to you, you shall do. When the famine was spread over all the face of the earth, then Joseph opened all the storehouses and sold to the Egyptians, and the famine was severe in the land of Egypt. The people of all the earth came to Egypt to buy grain from Joseph because the famine was so severe in all the earth. Good stewardship is both personal and it's governmental. The government had to exercise good stewardship to prepare the nation for the future. Leaders like Joseph and his overseers had to manage the resources well. But the people had to be good stewards too. The people were warned that they needed to save for the future because hard times were coming. I don't know about you, but saving is not always easy, especially if you're paying 20% in taxes. Yet there's personal responsibility that is part of good stewardship in any nation to save for the hard times. We know that's tough to save. There is actually a new tool out in the country of Japan to help people save. It is a new piggy bank, and it is adorned with a skull and crossbones. The piggy bank explodes if the owner fails to top it off regularly. And the money goes everywhere. If the bank explodes, users must collect the scattered coins and reflect on their laziness, the Japanese company said. Maybe we all need some piggy banks like that to make us reflect on our laziness, not to save, not to be personally responsible with what God gives us. Well, the day of reckoning came for the people of Egypt. Famine hit the Middle East. The people of Egypt had food, the text says. Nobody else did, but they did. They were prepared. They had saved. Now, you notice Joseph didn't start doling out the food right away. He held it. He saved it for when it got worse. He knows it's going to get worse. Finally, after time, the people cried out to Pharaoh for food. Pharaoh says, go to Joseph, and he'll take care of you. And he waited until it was time. Then he opened the storehouses of Egypt, and he sold the grain to the people. Now, lots of people have criticized Joseph for this. He sold the grain back to the people. Some have wondered, why didn't he give it back to them? Why is he selling it? Help the poor by giving them handouts is the thinking. Joseph didn't do that. He knew resources were limited. He knew human nature. Stewardship balances limited resources so that we can help as many as possible. That's what good stewardship does, both personally and governmentally. Starving refugees were going to be flowing to Egypt. They came flowing into the land looking for food. He had to manage resources, not only help the Egyptians, but to care for the needs of the starving refugees flooding his land. It is not enough if we help only our own. There is a moral responsibility to care for the needs of others. And Joseph understood that. And so he charged the Egyptians for the food as a way to manage the resources so that it would go farther for more people. People don't need handouts. People need hand-ups. You've heard that expression before. And we have a moral responsibility to care for those in need. We also have a moral responsibility to manage the resources that God gives us personally and governmentally. He sold the grain because it taught personal responsibility. It was good stewardship of the government resources. Missionaries learned this lesson many years ago. Missionaries used to hand out rice to the poor people as a way of meeting their needs. And what happened was they found out that people came to Christ, but they weren't really coming to Christ. They were known as rice Christians. They became Christians because of the rice. That's all. They came to the missionaries for handouts. They had not learned anything, any personal responsibility. If the missionaries left, they were just as bad off, not to mention that they were really interested only in following Jesus to fill their bellies. So missionaries changed their approach. They began to charge people for the rice. Nominal fee, not what it was worth, but charge them a fee for that rice. Then the missionaries began to teach the people good stewardship principles so they could live healthy lives. The church does not exist for handouts, but for hand-ups. It's a good concept of stewardship. When I grew up in Pakistan, Christian bookstores were an important part of the ministry, and Dad would often spend long time, many hours in the Christian bookstore wherever the town was we were located. And he would have many conversations with Muslim people there in the bookstore. They would come in gladly to talk. The bookstore offered a lot of Christian literature, including Bibles, but they were not free. They cost. They were for sale. The cost was minimal, but there was still a cost. And you know, there were certainly times when missionaries gave out much Christian literature for free when there was a need. But they had learned that giving away Christian literature was counterproductive. People didn't value it. They wasted it. And so Bibles would end up in the sewers because you gave it out, but it didn't go anywhere. It was worthless to them. But if a person paid something for it, then they were more likely to look at it and it had a real impact on their lives. And the money could then be used to expand the work. See, stewardship functions on many levels. It is not a simple concept. But it is biblical. There is a personal level where we must act responsibly. There's a church level, and tonight at our annual meeting, we will be exercising stewardship. For God has given us resources here, and we will be making decisions about how to use those resources responsibly in this world. And there is a governmental level. Our government is a steward of our taxes, and we expect them to use the money wisely. Prosperity requires good stewardship. And that is sometimes hard to implement in our lives, in our ministries, and in this world. Abdul al-Rahman III was a ruler in 10th century Spain. He lived in complete luxury. Here's how he assessed his own life. I have now reigned above 50 years in victory or peace, beloved by my subjects, dreaded by my enemies, and respected by my allies. Riches and honors, power and pleasure have waited on my call, nor does any earthly blessing appear to have been wanting to my felicity. I had everything I wanted. Everything. basically. Fame, riches, pleasure beyond imagination. Doesn't that sound great? He went on to write, I have diligently numbered the days of pure and genuine happiness which have fallen to my lot. They amount to, how many days in a 50-year life was he happy? 14. 14. I have numbered them and they are 14. Arthur Brooks assessed the life of Abd al-Rahman III. He said he had a formula as he sleepwalked through life. Love things, use people. It is the worldly snake oil peddled by the culture makers from Hollywood to Madison Avenue, but you know in your heart that it is morally disordered and a likely road to misery. You want to be free of the sticky cravings of unhappiness and find a formula for happiness instead. This is a New York Times editorial, right? Simply invert the deadly formula and render it virtuous. Instead of love things, use people. Love people, use things. Love people, use things. God calls every one of us in this room to invest our lives for Him, not for ourselves. Everything we have is His. He owns it all. As Colonel Sanders of Kentucky Fried Chicken famously said, there's no reason to be the richest man in the cemetery. Father, teach us that you bless us to use us. Teach us, Lord, to be Josephs in this world, maybe not because you call us to hugely prosperous and wealthy and powerful lives, but in the resources that you do give us, which quite frankly, Lord, are way beyond what most of this world knows and sees. You have blessed us so much. Help us to use them for you. In Jesus' name, amen.